John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, August 4th, 2011. The Israeli Air Force bombs Gaza City, and the Israeli housing crisis drives further illegal settlement development. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli Air Force has confirmed that it dropped two bombs on Gaza City Thursday morning. It claimed that two shells fired from Gaza had landed in southern Israel. According to local sources, the airstrikes hit a beachfront facility used by the armed wing of the Hamas party and a training camp used by the same group. There were no casualties reported. Concerning Israeli attacks last month, the International Relations Department at the PLO reported that, in July, Israeli soldiers killed six Palestinians, kidnapped 230 others, and demolished 32 homes and structures in the occupied territories. The monthly report, which was released on Wednesday, stated that Israel is targeting Palestinian residents, their lands, and their Muslim and Christian holy sites. There's lots of news from the Israeli Knesset today, starting with the Foreign Affairs and Security Committee. The committee stated that the Palestinian UN bid to seek international recognition of an independent state this coming September will worsen Israel's stance in the international arena and could lead to, quote, ongoing escalation, end quote. On the subject of the UN bid, a report to the Knesset Foreign Affairs and Defense Committee indicates that intelligence officials do not expect Palestinian violence following the September bid. Officials expect nonviolent protests, but still recommend activating reserve army units as a precaution. A new law has been proposed which recognizes the inherent contradiction in Israel's self-definition as both a democratic and a Jewish state, and calls on the government to favor Jewish law and traditions over democracy. It calls on Israeli courts to use Jewish law to make decisions, quote, in situations in which the Jewish character of the state clashes with its democratic character, end quote, and calls for Arabic to be removed as one of Israel's national languages. The bill also calls for the state to take action, quote, to ingather the exiles of Israel and further Jewish settlement within it and allocate resources to this end, end quote. Meanwhile, 42 MKs and cabinet members have petitioned Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to resolve the housing crisis by building in East Jerusalem and the West Bank. The petition was given to Netanyahu on Tuesday, signed entirely by members of the Eretz Yisrael lobby. In what appears to be a response to the petition and housing crisis, the Israeli government has on Thursday given final approval to build housing units in the settlement of Har Homa. Israeli media outlets are reporting that 903 new units have been approved for construction. And finally, in international news, for the second year in a row, Turkey is not participating in the naval drill Reliant Mermaid with Israel and the U.S. This action was taken by Israel as a result of the killing of 9 Turkish activists in the 2010 Gaza flotilla raid. Its abstention reflects the poor state of relations between Israel and Turkey due to Israel's refusal to apologize for the incident. That's all for today. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. This report has been brought to you from Occupied Bethlehem by Hussam Kassis and me, Danny Jones.
Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality after an apparent Afghan government soldier opened fire with small arms. This seems to just keep happening. Afghanistan today. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unreported nationality from an insurgent attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan Wednesday. NATO is reporting the death of 2 soldiers of unreported nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan Wednesday. NATO is reporting the death of another soldier of unreported nationality from a non-combat related injury in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Is this yet another GI suicide? Afghanistan Tuesday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in eastern Afghanistan. Afghanistan Monday. NATO is reporting the death of a soldier of unspecified nationality from an IED attack in an undisclosed location in southern Afghanistan. Afghanistan Tuesday. A suicide car bomb detonated outside a small residential hotel frequented by foreigners just after dawn, killing 4 guards as 2 other militants stormed the hotel in Kunduz City and engaged the Afghan police in a 2-hour gun battle. 4 Afghan building guards were killed and 10 other people, including an Afghan policeman, were wounded. Foreigners staying at the 2-story hotel escaped to the rear of the building. Ramadi, Iraq, yesterday. 2 bombs targeting police exploded, killing 9 people and wounding 13, according to Iraqi officials. The bombs exploded in central Ramadi, with the second one going off just steps away from the first after police and other people gathered on the scene. Yes, the standard 2-bomb first responder getter. Baghdad, Tuesday night. Iraq's former member of parliament, Iyad Jalaluddin, was wounded when a rocket scored a direct hit on his house. A security source told Aswan Al Iraq News Agency. Kukuk, Iraq, Tuesday. A car bomb outside the Syrian Catholic Church wounded 23 people, and security forces found in disabled vehicles packed with explosives outside 2 other parishes in northern Iraq. The parish's leader, Reverend Ahmad Yalda, was the only person inside at the time of the blast and was wounded. The 22 other wounded were people whose nearby homes were hit by the same blast, said Kirkuk Police Chief Major General Jamal Tahir. The 2 averted attacks were on the Christian Anglican Church and the Mar Gugis Church in the northern city of Kirkuk. Baghdad, yesterday. An Iraqi military officer and another person were killed and 6 people were wounded, 3 of them soldiers, in double bomb blasts in Abu Ghraib, West Baghdad. The first explosion took place in front of a billiard hall while the second one occurred in the same place when the Iraqi army patrol arrived. Baghdad, Wednesday. 4 Iraqis were killed in 2 successive bomb attacks targeting a liquor store in western Baghdad, police and health officials reported. A police officer said 13 other people were wounded in the blasts, which occurred in the capital's Fasala neighborhood. He said the first bomb went off near the shop, while the second came a few minutes later as police and residents rushed to the scene. 3 policemen were among those killed. Mr. Barack Obama, this shit's been going on for 8 years in Iraq and 10 in Afghanistan, and nothing ever seems to change. Well, one thing has. The U.S. can no longer afford to go to war, given that just last week there was talk of not paying the troops so the bankers could be paid instead if that debt ceiling bill didn't pass. Meanwhile, a number of fools in both the U.S. and Iraqi governments are negotiating about keeping U.S. troops past the end of the year, despite both the U.S. budget crisis and the vows of the Mahdi army to return to the battlefield with full force and fury if that withdrawal deadline is missed. Now is the time to pull the plug. Bring all the troops home today. On the 1st of August, Antonio Benjamin Martinez, entrapped by the FBI for allegedly planning to bomb an army recruiting station in Maryland, asked a federal judge to dismiss his case. He is Muslim, and when he said some things on Facebook the FBI didn't like, undercover FBI agents approached him and chose not to record their first 4 meetings with him, no doubt as they tried to browbeat him into doing something that would get him arrested. After repeated meetings with these undercover FBI agents, he finally agreed to detonate a car bomb at a military recruiter for them. I can just see what those agents were saying. Jihad is a pillar of Islam. Are you really a Muslim? I can see them challenging his manhood, telling him that Muslims in Iraq and Afghanistan set off car bombs, so why won't he? The FBI then went so far as to provide a fake car bomb and let him try to set it off. Why a car bomb? In case someone on the jury didn't object to a suitcase bomb with no civilians injured or killed, no doubt. We've seen this before, with the Sacramento 3 Earth Liberation Front case and the FBI's civilian undercover helper, Anna. She did the exact same thing, save that her words were chosen to trap environmentalists instead of Muslims, and even though it all came out in court, Eric McDavid still got a long prison sentence after both his co-defendants snitched. At least since Antonio Benjamin Martinez was working alone, he has only one snitch to worry about, Facebook, the people who started the whole thing. If you have any disputes with the government, any at all, don't use Facebook. Lastly, while fundamentalist Christians are in Maryland blustering threats against a Germantown abortion clinic, with a clinic burned in Texas just last week, the FBI is busy chasing Muslims, environmentalists, and animal rights activists and building fake bombs. Should they not instead be chasing the anti-abortion extremists who use real bombs?
Anders Behring Breivik, the confessed perpetrator in last month's bombing of Norway's government buildings in Oslo and a shooting rampage at a Labour Party youth camp that killed 77 people and wounded nearly 100, was motivated by his hatred of Muslim immigrants. In a 1,500-page manifesto published on the internet just before Breivik launched his terrorist attacks, the mass murder suspect declares that his violent operation of July 22nd was planned for 2 years in order to help halt the Islamization of Norway and Europe. In his manifesto titled 2083, A European Declaration of Independence, the 32-year-old Breivik describes himself as one of several leaders of the national and pan-European patriotic resistance movement. He anticipates a European civil war taking place in 3 stages, ending in 2083 with the execution of cultural Marxists and the deportation of Muslims. In laying out his views, Breivik extensively quotes many U.S.-based right-wing Christian activists who share his fear and hatred of Muslims and the threat they believe their religion poses to Western culture and democracy. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Chip Berlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates, who examines the motivation of the Norwegian mass murderer and the disturbing links with like-minded American Christian right organizations and individuals.
Well, essentially, he's really not a Christian fundamentalist. He's a moderate Christian by his own description, and he's part of a kind of global movement that sees basically the spread of Islam as threatening Western cultures. Or basically, if you took Huntington's thesis of the clash of civilization and armed it, you'd get Breivik. And of course, in the United States, these kinds of views are on Fox News. They're in major newspapers. They're in major media. The Islamophobia that's tolerated in the United States is pretty horrifying. And the particular line that Breivik followed is basically a conspiracy theory that cultural Marxism was created by the Frankfurt School ideologues, and that another name for that is political correctness or multiculturalism, and that those are the forces that allow Muslim immigration and the destruction of Judeo-Christian nations in Europe and the destruction of the United States. Now, the irony here is Breivik himself supports Israel and is what's called philo-Semitic. He likes the Jews because they're against the Muslims in his view, which is not accurate, but again, we're talking about his view. Some do, some don't. But the joke here is that the cultural Marxism thesis that he picked up by William S. Lind, who worked with Paul Weyrich at the Free Congress Foundation, a Christian right think tank in Washington, Lind went on to develop a very anti-Semitic version of this conspiracy theory in which it was the Jewish Marxists at the Frankfurt School who developed this to destroy Christianity and Christian culture. And so you have this strange thing where Breivik is neither a Christian Zionist, Christian right fundamentalist, nor is he a neo-Nazi. You might argue his xenophobia is so profound you could call him quasi-fascist, but he really represents the kinds of views that you can see in a lot of conservative right and Christian right publications warning about Islam.
And Chip, what was Breivik's motive for the massive scale of violence he perpetrated with the bombing in downtown Oslo and killing these kids, you know, one by one in the shooting rampage on the island where this political party had its youth camp?
Well, he saw himself as a new crusader. He says that he is part of a new Knights Templar movement, and the Knights Templar were soldiers in the Crusades against Islam and the Holy Land Wars. And so he basically saw himself as leading this new crusade to crush Islam as it was crushed before by Christian crusaders. And in the context of Norway's politics, the Progressive Labor Party, of course, was seen by Breivik and others on the right as promoting multiculturalism, and in fact they did promote tolerance and respect, and promoting basically policies which Breivik and other right-wingers wrongly attributed to their hatred of Christianity and Western culture. And so he set out to blow up the government building in which the Labor Party governed, and then it wasn't just a youth camp, it was a youth training camp for young activists in the Labor Party who were being groomed to go on into party positions in the government and in political life. So he saw himself as ridding Norway of the vermin, spreading cultural Marxism and political correctness, and thus allowing the Muslims to come in and wreck the society.
You have long followed right-wing movements in this nation, and as you've examined Breivik and his writings, you've discovered many links to U.S.-based Islamophobic groups and individuals and Christian right organizations. Tell us about some of the most significant links that you found and really what it means in terms of the rising of anti-Islamic movements in the United States.
There's a lot of people who have been looking at the influences. I track the actual writings of William S. Lind of the Free Congress Foundation, both attributed and unattributed in the Breivik manuscript. Others have tracked, especially Max Blumenthal, the massive empire of Islamophobia in the United States and how that has been playing into this promotion. The more you demonize and scapegoat a target group, the more likely it is that someone will see that as a call to violence, and it also allows the plausible deniability of saying, well, I never meant kill them. But of course, that was Hannah Arendt's basic thesis of understanding how totalitarian movements work, is that the leader says, who will rid me of these alien forces? And the most militant followers know that that's a call to rub them out.
That was Chip Erlay, senior analyst with Political Research Associates, Read more about the links between European and American anti-Islamic movements on our website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com.
In an unprecedented political act, congressional Republicans, driven by their right-wing Tea Party members, successfully used the nation's need to raise the debt ceiling to extort historic cuts in the federal budget. The deal, passed by the House and Senate and signed by President Obama on the deadline date of August 2nd, would raise the debt ceiling by $2.1 trillion in two steps and cuts $2.5 trillion from the budget over the next 10 years. The agreement features an initial spending cut of $1 trillion, followed by the formation of a 12-member bipartisan supercommittee that will be charged with recommending another $1.5 trillion in cuts by Thanksgiving that could include changes to Medicare and Social Security and tax increases. If Congress fails to adopt the committee's recommendations by December 23rd, the legislation will automatically reduce spending beginning in 2013, with half taken from both domestic and defense spending. Social Security, Medicaid, military, and civilian pensions, and most low-income programs would be exempt. Medicare cuts would be limited to payments to medical providers. Many progressive members of Congress voted against the debt ceiling deal, characterizing the 11th-hour agreement as a sellout of working families to Tea Party extremists engaging in political blackmail. Representative Emanuel Cleaver of Missouri, a member of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, labeled the deal as a sugar-coated Satan sandwich. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Dave Johnson, a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. He warns that the agreement was a total victory for right-wing extremists that rewards the rich and punishes the nation's poor and working families.
Well, we have signed on to almost entirely a conservative right-wing agenda here of cutting and cutting, preserving the tax cuts for the wealthy, and this was done with a gun to the country's head. They literally, and people got pretty sure they would do it, were going to force the country to default if we didn't give them what they want. It's astonishing to think about it, but it's actually only part of a series of these that we've now seen. Well, you remember the bailout, the huge bailout, where we saw the beginning of the pattern, where we're presented with this horrible crisis, the Congress has to act immediately to save the country, and the terms of it are that essentially we had to hand over a huge amount of money to bail out Wall Street and preserve their fortunes. And literally, we only had hours at the time that we had to do this before significant opposition could be rallied, before people had time to wake up and focus and get details and see if this was really the case and look at alternative ideas. Then we saw 2 years of obstruction of democracy, of almost every single thing that the Congress tried to do was then filibustered in the Senate. Even when we had that what's called a supermajority in the Senate, where there were enough Democrats elected to break these filibusters, we had Joe Lieberman break ranks and sometimes other members. Then we saw the tax extensions, where once again, they held a hostage. They said, we're not going to give anything to the unemployed if you don't renew these tax cuts for the wealthy. But then there was the government shutdown once again, and it all went to the very last minute so that to avert a government shutdown, the vote had to happen immediately because the negotiators took so long and were handed an announcement from on high somewhere so we, the people, don't get a chance to interfere. And we averted the government shutdown with a huge number of cuts in the things that our government does for us, that we, the people, our government, do for each other. And then this was the big kahuna of hostage taking. And I don't really need to relate a lot of what happened here, I guess.
Dave, in the second phase of this process, of raising the debt ceiling. There is the appointment of a bipartisan super committee that's supposed to arrive at lots more cuts. And Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, as well as the Pentagon budget, are all going to be on the table. There's a sort of Damocles hanging over the committee's head that if they don't come to an agreement somewhere near Thanksgiving, that automatic cuts that both the Democrats and Republicans dislike will go into effect. What can be done between now and Thanksgiving to rev up a progressive base who aren't very happy with this agreement as it stands now and are very worried about entitlement programs and cuts that very well could be made to them, especially given some of the statements of support for that very thing by President Obama? What can be done in this next few months?
First of all, if you're someone who cares about democracy, this whole process that has happened, and especially this idea that there's going to be this super Congress that then comes and tells us how it's going to be, it's kind of offensive, I think. But people are saying, look, we can at least try to get some really strong progressives on there to make sure that it doesn't just hear the same old centrist, as called, you know, you call it, well, we have to cut Medicare and Social Security, kind of a voice on this. So one thing you can do is you can call your members of Congress, your senators, and say, we want strong progressives put on this 12-member commission. Unfortunately, the commission will deadlock because you know that all six Republicans will refuse any kind of tax increases. Here we are again. We're in this bind. They lock it in before we can react and organize the forces of democracy to do something about this.
Dave Johnson, to close off here, it's clear by now to most of the country, and the polling data bears this out, that most people perceive the Republican agenda, and especially the Tea Party agenda, is to protect the wealthiest sector of the country at all costs, and including political blackmail to get their way, and that major threats are now posed against some of the most popular government programs over the decades, and that's Social Security and Medicare. And it seems that nothing short of a grassroots mobilization or rebellion is going to shake some sense into the White House and Congress to reject this kind of austerity, which has always led to the working families and the poor of this country to take the brunt, while the wealthy and the Republican supporters in Congress are laughing on the yachts drinking cocktails.
I would say one good thing I see is that more and more people are seeing this and understanding it. The problem is that there's no organized pressure sufficient on the Democrats that is doing as the old famous FDR statement where he said, I agree with you, I want to do it, now make me do it. We don't have that organizational structure in place to make them do it. And in a democracy, a politician has to respond to what they see out there as what the public wants. We're not currently well enough expressing that this is what the public wants and enforcing that, because we need to then be able to primary people who aren't with us. We need this grassroots movement you talked about. This was such a naked aggression against democracy, I think, that people are saying, hold on here, you know, do we really want a system that works like this? I am hopeful that we're actually going to see a good reaction, but unfortunately right now we're going to have to deal with a slower economy and the results of this hostage-taking we went through.
That was Dave Johnson, a fellow at the Campaign for America's Future. Read more critical analysis on the debt ceiling agreement at our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
I don't know what they're smoking on Capitol Hill, but it smells like dried-out, rolled-up turds. Believe me, I don't want to hit on that stuff, and I'm just hoping it goes out real soon.
Over the July 16th weekend, members of Respect DC invaded a Walmart in Laurel with drums, horns, and even a tuba. Singers demanded that Walmart respect DC while holding yellow smiley faces backed by an entire brass band. The whole group was able to enter the store and carry out their mission with no effective opposition from befuddled store security. The music you hear is recorded in the protest itself. The protesters were demanding living wages, labor rights, and realistic pensions and health care plans as a condition of Walmart's plans to build any stores in D.C.
Respect D.C. Respect D.C. the city, this is a movement. Music.
Have you heard the news?
Walmart's coming,
coming. Georgia Avenue, uptown. Ain't that something?
Something.
Small businesses, shop owners, hearts pumping. Cause they know their livelihoods is about to take a thumping.
Thumping.
See, you can't compete with a superstore who's an importer of slave labors. Craftsmanship, low price to flip to undercut the market. Hand over fist.
Walmart
is infamous for the way they behave. Low wage pay, treat the workers like slaves. Employees who try to unionize soon find themselves in unemployment lines. The way they treat women needs improving. 1.6 million sisters are suing them for being paid less than the male equivalent. On these issues and more, we can't afford to be ignorant.
Keep DC Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
This is the Funkinest Journalist with your three Walmart commandments. Step one, move in and crush competition by underselling. Step two, pay workers nothing and block unionization. Step three, take all that money, put it into the Walton Family Foundation, and turn that into political influence to protect yourself and make even more.
Walmart, it's not a good fit for Chocolate City. Let me holler black at you with the skinny. Important that you clearly understand and remember DC doesn't work with the right-wing agenda. The Walton families are big contributors to bigoted representatives and senators. Trent Lott, sinister. Strom Thurmond, similar. Confederate, state-loving George Bush ministers. Overseer plantation mentality results in black and brown casualties. Statehood opposition for the district has been supported by Walmart's mischief. The D.C. Voting Rights Act was defeated, assisted via Walmart PACs. And now they want to come here to see their money stack. Stay up on the facts. Chocolate City, don't relax and fight back.
Keep D.C. Walmart free. It won't benefit you or me. They ain't about spreading love in the community. They ain't about Chocolate City unity. Opportunists out to make a buck quick. Suck up all your resources and then they split. They try to come across as if they legit, but really their motives are counterfeit.
Keep DC Walmart free is an emerging activist group of DC residents stepping up to challenge the corporate big box invasion of Chocolate City. Walmart has plans to establish 4 stores in DC by 2012. Walmarts in DC will threaten small businesses, cause loss of more jobs than it will bring to the community, and lower the wage standards for all workers. To find out more and get involved, visit walmartfreedc.org.
Here is an update on the tree sitters who have blocked blasting at the Bee Tree Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine in West Virginia. On Tuesday, after 2 weeks of burning heat and pounding thunderstorms, one of the two tree sitters, Bex Collins, came down and was arrested. Bex was released without bail requirements shortly thereafter. The other tree sitter, Catherine Ann McDougal, is still in her tree and is refusing to descend, meaning that Mountaintop Removal Coal Mine has been shut down for over 2 weeks and is still shut down by the efforts of two tree sitters and a support team. Here's what Bec Collins had to say shortly after she was released.
Came down from the tree and was immediately arrested. I was initially charged with 13 counts of trespassing, conspiracy, and littering.
Littering? How about all the rocks thrown by blasting at these mountaintop removal mines? How about the unbelievable pollution they throw into rivers and streams? Who the hell are they to accuse anybody of littering? Meanwhile, the other tree sitter, Catherine Ann, is still at her platform 80 feet up in the trees, blocking all blasting in that section of the Bee Tree Surface Mine, a notorious mountaintop removal coal mine.
She's holding strong and she's planning on staying up there as long as she can. I think she can make it a while, yes. The area was really beautiful. There were lots of greens and browns. Every morning was really nice to wake up to. and I thought it was a really great 2 weeks. And when I came down and walked up the strip mine, I was able to see such a huge contrast, and I was able to see exactly like what the work I was doing was trying to stop, and it was really a huge reminder and really important for me.
We have to do this. We have to be a part of the solution. As citizens, we cannot sit back any longer and wait for the government to fix it. This problem is killing us, literally killing us.
Well, we, you know, you and I, we have to live on this place. If we don't take care of it, it won't take care of us.
Communities are being poisoned. Mountains are being destroyed. So as long as that is happening, we are going to continue fighting that way.
We have rights too that have been ignored for over 130 years, actually.
As a lot of us who are fighting are outsiders, we're able to use that privilege to speak up for those who can't speak up and to work to end the atrocities that are occurring.
And when Alfred said we want to do it the right way, somebody other than these people here behind me should be asking them, how come you're not going the right way?
If any of you bastards from Alpha Minerals are listening to this broadcast, or if you are a lobbyist for Alpha Minerals and are listening to this broadcast, I've got news for you. Ever heard of a woman named Julia Butterfly out on the West Coast? She sat in a redwood tree for 18 months to block logging of old-growth forest, which isn't even as serious as mountaintop removal, because in logging, they don't take away the mountain, they only take away the trees, which is bad enough. Do you think you can stay afloat? Do you think your bee tree service buying can stay in business if Catherine Ann McDougall stays in that tree for 18 months? You better be thinking about bank loans. You better be thinking about what you're going to do if you don't produce one more lump of coal for the next 18 months. Have you had enough of paying $3 to $4 a gallon for gas? Have you had enough of sitting in traffic as your sweat and your radiator compete to see who can boil over first? There's an alternative to putting up with being stuck in traffic. And contrary to what some of those guys leaning on the horns in their SUVs will tell you, you do in fact have the right to ride a bicycle on the street in downtown D.C. First Friday of every month, bicycle riders gather in DuPont Circle at 6 p.m. with a critical mass bike ride to emphasize this right. That's tomorrow, which is Friday, the 5th of August. Bicycle riders will gather at 6 p.m. in DuPont Circle, departing at about 6:30 for the critical mass bicycle ride. Here in D.C., critical mass is the first Friday of every month. In most other cities, it's the last Friday of every month, but not here. Tomorrow, the 5th of August, Friday, DuPont Circle, 6 p.m., depart 6:30. Bicycles will swarm into the streets to emphasize our right to ride bicycles in the streets of D.C. Critical mass, tomorrow! On the 26th of July, environmental activist Tim DeChristopher was sentenced to 2 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for doing nothing more than bidding against oil and gas companies on a last-minute George W. Bush land auction to so-called open up western lands for destruction by oil and gas companies. The bids he placed, 13 in all, disrupted the auction, caused it to be invalidated. And by the time things were straightened out, President Barack Obama was in office and the oil and gas leases were canceled, so the action was successful. Now the courts want their pound of flesh. On the 26th of July, protesters gathered outside federal courthouses in D.C., in Ohio, in about 20 cities in all, and there was a massive protest outside the Salt Lake City courthouse where Tim DeChristopher was sentenced, where he gave this speech.
That's the world wanted to see was how you would react. And you all have never acted with joy and resolve. You've shown that your power will not be intimidated by any power that they have. And that's the most important thing that has happened here this week. Because everything that went on inside that building tried to convince me that I was alone and that I was weak. They tried to convince me that I was like a little finger out there on my own that could easily be broken. And all of you out here were the reminder for all of us that I wasn't just a finger all alone in there, but that I was connected to a hand with many fingers that could unite as one fist. And that fist could not be broken by the power that they have in there. That fist is not a symbol of violence. That fist is a symbol that we will not be misled into thinking we are alone. We will not be lied to and told we are weak. We will not be divided, and we will not back down. That fist is a symbol that we are connected and that we are powerful. It's a symbol that we hold true to our vision of a healthy and just world, and we are building the self-empowering movement to make it happen. All those authorities in there wanted me to think like a finger, but our children are calling to us to think like a fist. And we know that now I'll have to go to prison. We know that now that's the reality. But that's just the job that I have to do. That's the role that I face. And many before me have gone to jail for justice. And if we're going to achieve our vision, many after me will have to join me as well.
I'll get you. I'll get you.
Be there.
Nobody ever told us that this battle would be easy. Nobody ever told us that we wouldn't have to make sacrifices. We knew that when we started this fight. Every wave on the ocean that has ever risen up and refused to lay back down has been dashed upon the shore. But it's the very purpose of a wave to rise up. Because once it rises above the horizon, it finally has the perspective to see that it's not just a wave, that it's a part of a mighty ocean. And the sharpest rock on the wildest shore can never break that ocean apart. They can never wear that ocean down. Because it's the ocean that shapes the shore. And that's what we're starting to do here today. That's what we're starting to do here this week. With wave after wave after wave crashing against that shore, we shape it to our vision. Thank you all for being a part of that.